From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, a special look at the U.S. elections right before Super Tuesday, including the California and New Jersey primaries. We begin with a look at U.S. foreign policy. RT's Afshan Ratanzi spoke with filmmaker and investigative journalist John Pilger.
Let's begin with, well, Ash Carter is in Singapore for this important security summit. Lots of presidential contenders presumably looking at this summit for the future. You say in your most recent piece that Obama's worldwide campaign of terrorism is unprecedented. Why is President Obama's terms in office signal such a shift in U.S. imperial powers, as you say?
Yes. I mean, Obama's almost a perfect example of the image and the reality. The image of Obama was of this interesting, eloquent African-American man who somehow rose through this vortex of politics right to the top and would bring a kind of new civilized attitude to America. All that was nonsense. Obama went to Prague in 2009 and stood up before an adoring crowd and said, the United States will help rid the world of nuclear weapons. Under Obama, nuclear warhead production is greater than under any post-Cold War president. There's something like $1 trillion have been earmarked for nuclear weapons production and development.
And yet he visited Hiroshima as the immediate.
Well, are acts of deep cynicism. And power at that level operates, yes, in a public relations sense, and that's very much today, where The Guardian has just published a picture of Obama frolicking with his family and his dogs, and what a wonderful human being clearly this man is. The other side, the cynicism of great power and great reckless power in many respects, is expressed at Hiroshima, where all the evidence shows that these, both Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were sacrificed as America's first expressions of violent power in the Cold War that was then underway. So, for Obama to go and talk about the atomic bombs as if God dropped them. He uses the passive voice, and really quite vomitous language, like we must have the courage to care. So no one dropped the atomic bombs. The United States certainly didn't kill all those hundreds of thousands of people. It didn't cause all that suffering. It's something that we should all express sympathy to. It was like a kind of high mass, so the great divinity was there, but not the United States. That's not to blame. That's been Obama's role as a PR man extraordinaire. And he came in to power. People fell on their knees. If you read mainly the liberal media, fell on their knees. This was a kind of second coming. There was a problem for the last few years with reigniting Afghanistan and Iraq destroying Libya and so on and so forth. But the fawning has begun again as Obama's time in office nears an end. And for people, for journalists to report that, as I say, deeply cynical action of Obama's and the United States in Hiroshima the other day, to report it without the context of all those survivors, and I've interviewed many of them, of how angry they were, many of them. But they're polite people and they're very elderly, but they were angry.
Because, of course, we're taught here at school that it ended the Second World War.
Well, we're taught a lot of things in school. We used to be taught that that all Indians love the British Empire and the Great Famine of 1943 was somehow excluded, and that the Mau Mau were uniquely terrible people. The British did nothing in Kenya that warranted this kind of resistance, and we were taught, in other words, we were taught a lot of imperial nonsense most of the time. I think I probably spent the first, after school, I probably spent the first 20 years trying to revise it, what I'd been taught.
And now a look at the aftermath of this past weekend's trading of recrimination from one candidate to another, and Bernie Sanders' announcement that there will be a brokered convention. We spoke with Professor Tony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia Monday morning. Professor Montero, pleasure as always.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be with you, Don, again.
Thanks. So, yeah, it was an interesting weekend. You've got Clinton acting like the coronation has already taken place, the media disregarding what it means to be a superdelegate, that you can't commit. Well, you get appointed and you vote at the convention, and that's it. What you say in the interim is meaningless. You got Trump talking about his case and imputing conflict of interest to the judge over this Trump University case, and everybody screaming at each other on TV. What do you see going into New Jersey, California, the others on Tuesday?
Well, I think what we're looking at is the continuation in the Republican and Democratic parties of insurgency movements, the likes of which we have never seen in the history of this country. And it seems to me that tomorrow, on Tuesday, in California, the insurgency that is supporting Bernie Sanders will reach a high point, after which we enter the next stage of the struggle. And I would emphasize that the struggle is not just to get Bernie Sanders the nomination. That is part of it. But it is a larger struggle to defeat the forces of money and the forces of austerity and the forces of militarism that control the Democratic Party. And here I wish to emphasize that many people, especially those on the left, many of those on the left, don't get it. This is bigger than Bernie Sanders. This is about a movement. The 65 or so thousand people that turned out in Oakland about a week ago goes beyond Bernie Sanders. He doesn't have that kind of charisma or personal attraction. This is a movement based upon principle and principled unity. At the same time, the Trump movement, which is a part of the working class in particular, that part of the white working class that have felt so alienated by the political elite that they abandoned the Democratic Party, and then in 2010 they abandoned the Republican Party and went to the Tea Party. But now it seems that they have found what is a temporary home, because Trump is talking about the economic issues that confront them and the economic forces that are destroying the working class generally and the middle class. But in particular, when we talk about the Trump movement, the white working class.
You know, I'm listening to all the talking heads over the weekend as they attempt to position Clinton for Sanders supporters. They make a glancing reference to the trade deals that have devastated the manufacturing sector in the United States and more or less cleaned the clock of the working class. And, you know, other issues that pertain to jobs, essentially. And and also austerity. You know, Clinton is there saying basically, well, you know, Sanders and I agree on what the issues are. We just have a different method of presenting it. And Trump is dangerous and he and I disagree on everything. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the commonality are these class issues and particularly the economic issues that the working class faces. How do you bridge like this massive media effort to completely disguise that?
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it is that both insurgencies movements have turned to social media, and it becomes kind of a way of getting out a alternative message. On the other side, it is word of mouth and these large gatherings and rallies. Where people come to their own conclusions. Now, of course, the establishment has most of the instruments of power and of propaganda and are attempting to shape the narrative. They sense that during the primary season, they lost control of the narrative, especially in the Republican Party. Now they're trying to regain it. But to position Hillary as not just the Democratic nominee, but the nominee of big money and of the warfare state, I don't think it's going to work. Now, that doesn't mean that Clinton might not get the nomination. But I think the larger picture is one where the country is becoming increasingly ungovernable. And all it will take, and this is not out of the range of possibility, is another recession, even a mild recession, to send this thing into a universe none of us have ever experienced. So I think we're in a period of the formation of battle lines, strictly drawn battle lines. And in fact, the battle lines are along the class line. In other words, separating the two sides based upon their attitude towards the interests and needs of working people and the middle class.
One of the big talking points for that propaganda effort to regain control of the narrative is, of course, Trump. He's a fascist, he's a racist, and, you know, he cooperates in constructing that narrative with some of the things that come out of his mouth, but the conclusion one is supposed to draw from that is that they have to support Hillary Clinton, and they don't examine whether or not she's a racist or a fascist, and we've seen that, however, being examined at blackagendareport.com. Margaret Kimberly last week wrote on exactly that, and we spoke with her here. Also, as you referenced this last week when we were talking about this, Mumia Abu-Jamal, who says that perhaps the way to, you know, the cost of getting rid of Clinton and the neoliberals who are really neocons in disguise is a Trump presidency. What do you see in terms of both that and, of course, Sanders as someone who doesn't have Clinton's history as someone who makes racist policy?
Mm-hmm. Well, as I've always said on your shows, it is my estimate that Clinton represents a coming together of forces, a united front of forces that are not adverse to fascism in this country or anywhere else in the world. And that has been the case for some time. We could speak of certain aspects of her husband's presidency, most of which she takes credit for, as a pre-authoritarian period in American history, where a lot of the things that the Reagan Republicans had talked about, the Democrats under Clinton, Bill Clinton, that is, implemented. Fascism in this country is not an event or a personality. It is a process of consolidation, the forces of Wall Street, such as Goldman Sachs in particular, the forces of austerity, and most significantly, the forces of war. As I have said in conversations that we have had, that the key element of fascism is war. Now, you know, of course, domestic repression and structural violence has to be included in that, as well as a restricting of the political and free speech and civil liberty rights of the broad masses of people and of dissident intellectuals. But all of that for the sake of conducting war, silencing the people, making their economic conditions desperate, thus creating circumstances where war is an easy sell. Now, if war is the principal defining variable to fascism, then I think the fascist in this election cycle is clear. And who is the most committed to war? Well, it's Hillary Clinton, you know. And I think that's what we have to be awakened to. The corporate media, which, by the way, has supported all of these wars over the last 20 years, including the most brutal sanctions against nations like Iran and Iraq, the assassinations of leaders, and so on and so forth. So it is no surprise that the corporate media at this moment are supporting the most pro-war, pro-interventionist candidate in the race and trying to make her appear to be a peace candidate.
Yeah, with the record as Secretary of State or as a senator on her own, and of course as a salesperson for her husband's administration, you're looking at, during Bill Clinton's time, the deconstruction of the New Deal, and that began with an attack on black folks.
Yeah, there is no question about it, or an attack upon welfare and so-called criminals, which was sold with a black face, I would say. In other words, the Clinton administration and Bill Clinton himself, you know, took up all of the stereotypes of the Nixon administration as regards black poverty and this image of the welfare queen. And the first Bush administration, you know, labeling black people as inherently criminal, it took on both of these tropes, these stereotypes, to sell its welfare and so-called anti-crime legislation. In this respect, Bill Clinton went beyond Nixon and Reagan in advancing the agenda of the right, of the Republicans. And we see that being continued in the Obama administration. A different talk, a different narrative, but the substance is the same, which suggests that these policies, the policies of austerity, the policies of bringing down major parts of the New Deal and attacking others such as Social Security, is not just a Republican or Democratic agenda. It is the agenda of the ruling elite of this country. That's why these insurgency movements are so important, because they are attacking the very elite in the Republican and Democratic Party, which have given us the policies that have left growing numbers, if not the majority of the American working people, either in poverty or very near to it.
You have similar, I don't know if they're based in the same cultural conditions, but a very similar phenomenon going on in Europe, where
On the one hand, the European Union and NATO as adjuncts of U.S. foreign policy are being challenged not just by the left, but by the right. There's a nationalist strain that's running across Europe. It's been excited or stimulated by the movement of refugees from the wars that are being conducted by the U.S. and the EU and the Middle East and Africa. But they keep going to essentially the issue of national sovereignty and looking at the EU as a place where the sovereignty of the individual nations has been placed at the disposal of the United States and also NATO the same. They share that with Trump. What is that about?
Well, you know, this is a big question. In Europe in particular, it's more pronounced with the European Union. Because the question becomes not only what is sovereignty, national sovereignty, but what is citizenship? And what rights do citizens have in the face of this huge bureaucracy that runs the European Union? You know, it's a similar thing in this country. Do citizens have any rights in a moment of neoliberal globalization, where corporations are now defined as citizens with political rights, the same as a citizen, a person. So people, perhaps not being able to articulate all of this, are reacting to it. These trade policies and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, If it goes through, will be the gold standard of neoliberal globalist policies, which drive the majority of the world's people into poverty and deep poverty, while corporations become richer and richer, and the governments of various nations, especially in Europe and the United States, tell their people that we can't afford social programs like universal health care, free college and university, basic education, public education, and on and on and on, clean air. So people are reacting to the consequences of this whole globalized corporatist policy that goes back in its most virulent form, most intense form, to the Bill Clinton administration.
And in terms of those policies, it seems that the distinguishing rhetorical difference between neoliberalism and neocons, neoconservatism, center on symbolic issues of race, not material ones, but symbolic ones. You have Clinton's actual policy and Obama's, by the way, for example, towards immigrants. On the one hand, challenging Trump over his language in reference to this court case of his, where, you know, he imputes essentially a conflict of interest to the judge because he's of Mexican heritage, and speculating that if he were in a similar situation and there were a Muslim judge, that they might also present a conflict of interest because of Trump's policies as spoken. But in fact, you have President Obama kicking more immigrants out of the United States than all presidents combined in history. And of course, both Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and Barack Obama conducting a war on Islam across the Middle East and North Africa. So how do you parse that for the electorate?
Well, I think in relationship to Mexican and Central American immigrants, there are some factors that we cannot overlook. Number one, the dirty wars that the Americans sponsored and funded in Nicaragua and El Salvador and other parts of South America during the 80s and 90s, which created a social breakdown, the rise of the underground economy and gangs, and thus people fleeing the terror and impoverishment of Central American countries like El Salvador and coming to the United States seeking refuge. In the case of Mexico, and of course Central America again, NAFTA and its offshoots destroyed the Central American and Mexican peasantry by opening up the Mexican economy to American agriculture. And hence, the answer to the problem of immigration is not just to attack, not to attack the immigrants, but to attack the policy that produces immigration from Mexico or from Central America. And of course, the Mexican government, in collusion with the multinational corporations and banks and the American government, are very willing to export their own class contradictions to the United States, creating not just migrants, but people who live in a nomadic and precarious situation and will only live in that situation for the foreseeable future. We have to attack the policy, and that policy is the policy of both the American and Mexican government, and it is a policy of exporting their own class contradictions. And as far as the United States is concerned, the big corporations here, creating a labor force with no rights, who are not citizens, who have no sovereign protection, which means legal protection. So they are almost like perpetual nomads who are seeking some form of economic stability. And I might add, you see the same thing in the Gulf states with Filipinos and Pakistanis and Afghans and others who are migratory or nomadic labor without any rights.
And finally, some of the official media, like Politico in particular, are predicting that there might be up to 20,000 people protesting Hillary Clinton's coronation in Philadelphia. You're in Philadelphia, an activist there for many, many years. What are your predictions about how many people are going to be there?
Well, I think we're looking at tens of thousands, maybe into the hundreds of thousands. Because so much of what will happen is spontaneous, it's very difficult at this point to make an estimate. I know they want, that is the elite in the Democratic Party, they want Sanders to cool his people out and to, before the convention or after Tuesday, to along with Clinton, turn their focus upon Trump. I don't know that that Sanders will do that, but I'm certain that the movements that have coalesced around him, such as the environmental movement, the movement of young people and millennials, the dissident elements within the trade union movement, and the left and progressive forces, especially among the youth in the African American and Latino communities. I think that these forces are self-organized. They are overwhelmingly anti-capitalist, by the way, especially the younger
yes.
who are driving this movement. So I think it's hard to say. I've been predicting that it's possible for upwards of 300,000 protesters to descend upon Philadelphia in July.
Professor Montero, thank you. A pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.